Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper A Fair Go. How belief in a just world shaped attitudes, intentions, and behaviours before and after the Australian referendum on a First Nations voice to Parliament. Less than intro greater than. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we dive deep into the most fascinating research papers. I'm Tom. And I'm Jen. Today we're exploring a timely and thought-provoking study on beliefs about justice and fairness, and how they shaped attitudes and behaviours around a historic referendum in Australia. The paper is titled A Fair Go. How belief in a just world shaped attitudes, intentions, and behaviours before and after the Australian referendum on a First Nations voice to Parliament. The authors are Jonathan Bartholomaeus and Peter Strellan from the University of Adelaide. This research gets to the heart of a fundamental human need, the desire to believe the world is a fair and just place. And it examines how that belief, or lack thereof, can influence our political views and actions, especially when it comes to addressing long-standing injustices against marginalized groups. It's a captivating study that offers important insights into the psychology behind complex social and political issues. Let's dive in and unpack their key findings. Less than, intro greater than less than body greater than. In October 2023, the Australian government held a referendum on whether to enshrine in the Constitution an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to Parliament. This advisory body would give the country's First Nations people a formal way to provide input on issues affecting them. The debate around the voice referendum really got to the core of questions about justice and who deserves fair treatment in Australian society. So the researchers decided to apply the psychological theory of belief in a just world, or BJW, to understand how people's views on the referendum were shaped. The belief in a just world is the idea that people generally get what they deserve, that the world is a fair and orderly place where good actions are rewarded and bad actions are punished. People with a strong BJW tend to have an optimistic view that the world is fundamentally just. Exactly. And the researchers looked at two distinct aspects of BJW. BJW Other, which is the belief that the world treats other people fairly, and BJW Self, which is the belief that the world treats the individual fairly. They hypothesized that those with high BJW Other would be more likely to oppose the voice referendum, since it challenges the idea that the world is already fair and just for Indigenous Australians. But they thought people with high BJW Self might be more likely to support the referendum, since they see the world as generally rewarding people's efforts. To test this, the researchers conducted a longitudinal study, surveying a diverse sample of over 250 non-Indigenous Australians before and after the referendum vote. At the first time point, they measured the participants' BJW, along with their support for the voice, their intentions to share positive views about it, and their beliefs in its potential efficacy. And then at the second time point, after the referendum had taken place, they asked participants how they had voted, as well as their opinions on the outcome, their perceptions of its fairness, and their tendency to rationalize the results. The results were really fascinating. At the pre-vote stage, they found that higher BJW Other was associated with less support for the voice, lower intentions to share positive views, and less belief in its efficacy. But BJW Self showed the opposite pattern. It was positively linked to these pro-voice attitudes and intentions. Interestingly, when the researchers controlled for other factors like right-wing authoritarianism, social dominance orientation, and political ideology, the negative effects of BJW Other disappeared. But the positive effects of BJW Self largely remained. That suggests the relationship between BJW Self and support for the voice was more robust and independent of other ideological beliefs. People who saw the world as treating them fairly were more open to efforts to address injustice for Indigenous Australians. And when it came to actual voting behaviour, the story was a bit different. At the post-vote stage, BJW Other no longer predicted whether people voted yes or no on the referendum. But those higher in BJW Self were less likely to support the voice outcome. That's a really intriguing finding. It implies that while BJW Self was associated with more positive intentions and attitudes before the vote, when it came time to actually cast their ballot, those high in BJW Self were more likely to oppose the referendum passing. The researchers think this could be because people high in BJW Self are motivated to protect their own sense that the world is fair, and might have seen the voice as undermining that. So their personal belief in justice ended up overriding any sympathy they may have had for addressing Indigenous disadvantage. Absolutely. And the study also looked at how BJW influenced perceptions of the referendum outcome itself. Higher BJW other was linked to more positive views of the outcome, seeing it as more fair, and rationalizing the results. But again, BJW self showed the opposite pattern. It's a complex and nuanced picture. This research really highlights how our fundamental beliefs about justice and deservedness can shape our political attitudes and behaviors in profound ways. Even when we think we're being objective, our worldviews can subtly but powerfully guide us. Exactly. And the longitudinal design of this study is particularly valuable, because it allows the researchers to make stronger inferences about causality. They weren't just capturing snapshots, they were able to see how people's beliefs shaped their intentions and then their actual actions over time. That's a great point. This isn't just a cross-sectional look at correlations. By measuring BJW before the referendum and then assessing outcomes after, the researchers have a much stronger basis to conclude that people's pre-existing beliefs about justice were influencing their political choices. Absolutely. And the inclusion of those key control variables, like political ideology and prejudicial attitudes, is also really important. It helps tease apart the unique role of BJW, beyond just people's broader worldviews. There's a lot of nuance and sophistication to this study. Definitely. This research makes a significant contribution to our understanding of the psychology behind political decision-making, particularly when it comes to complex issues of social justice and minority rights. It shows how deeply rooted our beliefs about fairness and deservedness can be, and how those beliefs can have real-world impacts. Absolutely, this is a powerful example of how psychological theories like belief in a just world can provide valuable insights into thorny societal debates. It's a really thought-provoking study, and I'm sure it will spur a lot of discussion and further research in this area. You know, what I found most interesting about this research is how it highlights the tension between personal beliefs about justice and efforts to address systemic injustices. On one hand, having a strong sense that the world treats you fairly can be psychologically beneficial and empowering. But when that belief clashes with acknowledging unfairness toward others, it can lead people to resist or rationalize that unfairness. Definitely, it really gets at the heart of a fundamental human psychological need, the desire to believe in a predictable, orderly world where good is rewarded and bad is punished. When that belief is challenged, even with the noble goal of addressing marginalization, it can trigger all sorts of defensive reactions. And I think that's why this longitudinal design is so valuable. It allows us to see how those psychological processes play out over time, from initial reactions to eventual behaviors. The fact that BJW self-shifted from predicting support to opposition between the pre-vote and post-vote stages is a really striking finding. Absolutely, it suggests that even people who start out sympathetic to efforts to address injustice may end up opposing them when it comes time to take concrete action. Their own sense of personal fairness and deservedness can end up overriding their concern for others. That's a really important insight. And it raises tough questions about how we can foster a sense of justice and fairness for all, not just for ourselves as individuals. This research highlights how difficult that can be, even for well-intentioned people. Exactly, there's no easy answer, but studies like this can help us better understand the psychological barriers we're up against. Acknowledging the power of our personal biases and belief systems is an important first step toward creating a more equitable and just world. Definitely. And I think this research also points to the value of longitudinal studies more broadly. Being able to track how people's beliefs and intentions translate into actual behaviors over time is so insightful. It's a methodological approach I'd love to see more of in psychology and the social sciences. Absolutely, this is a great example of how that kind of rigorous, multi-stage research can yield really nuanced and impactful findings. It's a model for how to tackle complex, real-world issues in a way that balances scientific rigor with real-world relevance. Couldn't agree more. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a really thought-provoking piece of research. I'm sure our listeners are going to come away from this episode with a much richer understanding of the psychology behind political debates around social justice issues. Definitely, there's so much to unpack here. But I think the key takeaway is just how deeply our most fundamental beliefs about fairness and deservedness can shape our political views and actions, often in ways that may surprise us. It's a powerful reminder of the importance of examining our own biases and worldviews. Absolutely. This is the kind of research that really gets you thinking. I'm sure our listeners will be pondering these ideas long after this episode ends. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. This has been a fascinating exploration of a fair go. My pleasure, Tom. It's been a great discussion. Until next time, listeners, keep exploring the fascinating world of cutting-edge research with us. Reflections > conclusion > To summarize the key takeaways from this study on a fair go, the researchers found that people's belief in a just world, both for others, BJW other, and for themselves, BJW self, played a significant role in shaping their attitudes, intentions, and behaviors around the Australian referendum on establishing an Indigenous voice to Parliament. Those high in BJW other tended to be less supportive of the voice initiative before the vote, while those high in BJW self were more supportive. But when it came time to actually vote, the pattern shifted. Those high in BJW self were more likely to oppose the referendum passing, seemingly to protect their own sense of personal fairness. This highlights how our fundamental beliefs about justice and deservedness can profoundly influence our political views and actions, often in complex and nuanced ways. Even our efforts to address systemic injustices can clash with our personal needs to see the world as fair. Grappling with these psychological barriers is crucial if we want to create a more equitable society. Studies like this provide valuable insight into the deep-seated beliefs that can stand in the way of progress, and the importance of examining our own biases. It's a thought-provoking exploration of the psychology behind contentious political debates. I'm sure our listeners will be reflecting on these ideas for a long time to come. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. > conclusion > Here's a funny and weird commercial for a new company that exists as a result of the research paper A Fair Go. How belief in a just world shaped attitudes, intentions, and behaviours before and after the Australian referendum on a First Nations voice to Parliament sad face jingle plays. Do you ever feel like the world is out to get you? Like no matter how hard you work, the universe just won't cut you a fair go. Well, have we got the product for you? Introducing Just World Insurance. That's right, at Just World Insurance, we believe you deserve to be treated fairly. So we'll make sure the universe pays up when life inevitably screws you over. Got passed over for that big promotion because your boss is a jerk. Boom, Just World Insurance has got your back. Car got totaled by a reckless driver. Never fear, Just World Insurance will make sure karma comes around. And if you ever feel like the whole system is rigged against you, we'll send a horde of kangaroos to ransack Parliament House. That's what we call justice, mate. So don't just sit there fuming that the world is unfair. Protect your sense of personal justice with Just World Insurance. Just call 1-800-FAIRGO and let us restore balance to your universe. Because you, my friend, deserve a fair go. Jingle plays. Hello and welcome to another episode of our award-winning podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen. Hi there. Today, we have a really fascinating paper to dive into with you all. It's titled Pseudo-Factor Analysis of Language Embedding Similarity Matrices, New Ways to Model Latent Constructs, and it was authored by Nigel Ganol, E. Damiano D'Urso, Andrew Samo, and Tianjin Sun. This paper is all about using cutting-edge language models and techniques to better understand and model the underlying, latent structures of psychological constructs, even before collecting any actual data. The researchers introduced something called pseudo-factor analysis, which allows them to explore the measurement models and factor structures of assessments like personality inventories in a whole new way. That's right, Tom. The key idea here is that by analyzing the similarities between how different scale items are represented in language models, the researchers can get a sense of how those items might cluster together and define broader psychological factors, without ever having people actually respond to the items. Exactly. This is a really clever approach that builds on some recent work using large language models, or LLMs, in psychological research. As the authors explain, earlier studies showed that you can use these language models to estimate something called pseudo-discrimination, which is a way of gauging how well an individual item aligns with its intended psychological construct, just based on the semantic similarity between the item content and the construct definition. But this new paper takes things a step further by looking at the broader factor structure, not just individual item construct relationships. The researchers wanted to see if they could use these language-based similarity matrices to model the latent, underlying dimensions that psychological measures are trying to capture, again, all without any actual response data. That's right. And they tested this pseudo-factor analysis approach on two well-established personality inventories, the IPIP Neo 300, which measures the Big Five personality traits, and the IPIP HEXACO 240, which looks at the Big Six factors of the HEXACO model. The cool thing is, the researchers didn't just use one language model. They explored a whole range of different transformer-based models, including base models, distilled models, and even a model fine-tuned specifically for psychological applications. This allowed them to see how the pseudo-factor structures compared across these different approaches. Absolutely. And what they found was really quite remarkable. Across the various transformer models and encoding methods they tried, the pseudo-factor analyses revealed factor structures that were highly consistent with the well-established empirical factor structures of these personality inventories. That's really impressive. It suggests that you can basically reverse engineer the latent measurement models of psychological scales just by looking at the semantic relationships between the item content, without ever having to collect any actual responses. Exactly. And the implications of this are quite significant. Imagine being able to evaluate the factor structure of a new psychological measure or assessment, or even explore potential new factor structures, all before you've even administered the scale to a single participant. That could dramatically streamline the measure development and validation process. Definitely, it opens up all sorts of exciting possibilities. The researchers even suggest this approach could be used for theory generation, using the pseudo-factor structures to uncover potentially new, unexpected dimensions or constructs that the original scale developers didn't anticipate. That's a really intriguing idea. And I have to say, the way the researchers implemented and tested this pseudo-factor analysis approach is quite elegant. They were really thoughtful in how they handled things like item wording and directionality, trying different encoding methods to see what worked best. Absolutely, they didn't just take a simplistic approach. They recognized the nuances involved in how language models might process positively and negatively worded items, for example, and adjusted their methods accordingly. That kind of attention to detail is really important when you're working with these complex language models. Definitely. And I think one of the other strengths of this study is just how well-grounded it is in existing psychological theory and measurement principles. The researchers didn't just throw some language models at personality data and see what happened. They carefully selected well-validated personality inventories as their test cases, and they constantly compared their pseudo-factor results back to the established empirical factor structures. That's a great point. They really leveraged their deep understanding of psychometrics to make sure this new pseudo-factor analysis approach was producing results that aligned with and built upon our existing knowledge. That rigorous, theory-driven approach is crucial for developing new techniques that can be trusted and applied with confidence. Absolutely. And I have to say, as someone who's really interested in the intersection of AI, language, and psychology, I found this paper to be a fantastic demonstration of how these powerful language models can be harnessed to advance our scientific understanding of the human mind. Definitely, it's a great example of how emerging technologies can complement and enhance traditional psychological research methods, rather than simply replacing them. The pseudo-factor analysis approach seems to offer a valuable new tool for researchers to have in their toolbox. Definitely. And I'm really excited to see where this line of research goes next. The authors themselves point out some exciting potential extensions, like applying this to structural equation modeling or other advanced psychometric techniques. The possibilities seem endless. I agree, Tom. This is just the beginning. As language models continue to advance and become more sophisticated, I can see pseudo-factor analysis and similar approaches becoming increasingly powerful and influential in psychological science. It's a really thrilling area of inquiry. Absolutely. Well, listeners, I hope you found this discussion as fascinating as we did. This paper is a great demonstration of how cutting-edge AI and language technologies can be leveraged to deepen our understanding of the human mind and behavior. We'll be sure to keep an eye out for any future developments in this exciting field. That's right, Tom. And as always, you can find a link to the full paper and all of our show notes on our website. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Take care, everyone. Are you tired of the endless psychometric surveys and personality tests that always leave you feeling like a number? Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing PseudoPsych, the first of its kind eye-powered psychometric assessment without the hassle of actually, you know, taking a test. That's right. PseudoPsych uses the power of language models to analyze your personality from your online search history, social media posts, and secret dream journal entries. No tedious questionnaires required. Just let our advanced algorithms do their thing, and we'll provide you with a comprehensive personality profile complete with pseudo-factor analysis, pseudo-trait scores, and even pseudo-career recommendations. It's psychology without the psycho. And the best part? PseudoPsych is completely free. Because let's be honest, who has the time or attention span for those long, boring assessments anyway? So if you're ready to discover your true self without lifting a finger, head to pseudopsych.com and let the magic of AI unlock the depths of your pseudo-psyche. Pseudo-satisfaction guaranteed. PseudoPsych. The future of personality assessment is now, and it's wonderfully, weirdly, pseudo-scientific. Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we dive deep into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen. Hi everyone. In this episode, we'll be exploring a fascinating paper that investigates how crowdsourcing can be used to combat the spread of misinformation online. The title of the paper is Scaling Crowdsourcing Interventions to Combat Misinformation, and it was authored by Clara Pretis, Helena Gil-Buitrago, Irene Sisma, Rosamund C. Hendricks, and Daniela Lizarazo-Villarreal. Misinformation has become a pressing global issue, threatening the very foundations of democracy and our shared reality. The researchers in this paper recognize that current fact-checking efforts often fall short, especially when it comes to politically charged content that appeals to people's partisan biases. But they've uncovered an intriguing solution, using the wisdom of the crowds to help people identify misinformation. That's right, Tom. The key insight here is that when you aggregate the judgments of a diverse group of people, their collective assessment can actually be more accurate than that of individual experts. It's a bit like the classic Ask the Audience lifeline on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. The crowd often knows best. Exactly. The researchers explain that crowdsourcing taps into this wisdom of the crowds phenomenon. By having a large, diverse group of internet users evaluate the truthfulness of online content, the combined assessments can provide a fast and effective way to fact-check information at scale. But as the researchers point out, simply getting the crowd to weigh in on the accuracy of posts isn't enough. There are three crucial psychological factors that determine whether crowdsourcing interventions will be successful in combating misinformation. Let's dive into each of them. The first factor is trust in the fact-checking sources. If people don't trust the individuals or organizations doing the fact-checking, they're less likely to be swayed by the crowd's judgments, even if they're accurate. In highly polarized environments, this can be a major hurdle. Absolutely. Partisan echo chambers mean that people are more likely to trust fact checks that align with their own ideological leanings. So getting buy-in from across the political spectrum is key. The second factor is cognitive dissonance. How much the fact check contradicts someone's pre-existing beliefs. The more dissonant the information, the harder it is for people to update their views, even when presented with compelling evidence. Right, and this is a big problem with misinformation, especially when it reinforces people's political identities and worldviews. Overcoming that psychological resistance is crucial. The final factor is the size of the crowd doing the fact-checking. Larger, more diverse groups tend to produce more accurate collective judgments. But that raises tricky questions about implementation. Who gets to see and contribute to the crowdsourced fact-checks? Exactly. If everyone can see and contribute to the fact-checks, it could lead to coordinated attempts to game the system and take down content that doesn't align with certain political agendas. But if people only see fact-checks from their own ideological in-groups, that just reinforces echo chambers. The researchers propose a balanced approach that leverages network analysis to connect people with fact-checks from outside the normal bubbles, while still maintaining trust in the sources. It's a delicate balance, but one that could be the key to scaling crowdsourcing interventions effectively. The researchers also highlight the broader potential of crowdsourcing to reinforce norms around fact-checking and shared responsibility for content moderation. When people see that others are actively identifying and flagging misinformation, it can create a powerful social incentive to do the same. And that's the real promise of this approach, not just improving the accuracy of fact-checking, but fundamentally shifting the social dynamics around the spread of misinformation. It's a holistic, systems-level solution that could have profound impacts. Absolutely. The researchers conclude by outlining exciting avenues for future research, exploring how crowdsourcing can be combined with other individual and technological interventions to create a multi-layered defense against the scourge of misinformation. This paper is a brilliant example of how creative, interdisciplinary research can tackle some of the most complex and pressing challenges of our time. By drawing on psychology, network science, and the wisdom of the crowds, the authors have outlined a path forward that could help restore trust, truth, and the integrity of our public discourse. Couldn't agree more, Tom. This is the kind of work that gets us excited about science and its ability to make a real difference in the world. I can't wait to see how this field of research continues to evolve and make an impact. Me neither, Jen. This has been a fascinating dive into a truly important paper. Listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this episode and that it's left you with plenty to think about when it comes to combating misinformation. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening, everyone. Are you tired of being bombarded by misinformation online? Tired of not knowing what's real and what's fake? Introducing Fact Frenzy, the world's first crowdsourced truth verification service. Just send us a suspicious post or article, and our army of truth-seeking internet sleuths will swarm all over it. In seconds, Fact Frenzy's high-powered algorithms will aggregate the judgments of thousands of users to determine the truthiness of any claim. But that's not all. Our unique dissonance dampener technology helps users overcome their own cognitive biases and partisan blinders. That's right. Fact Frenzy cuts through the noise and gives you the facts, no matter how much they might clash with your pre-existing beliefs. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for Fact Frenzy today and become a champion of truth in the digital age. Fact Frenzy. Because reality is stranger than fiction. Fact Frenzy, crushing misinformation one crowdsourced judgment at a time. Tom and Jen, Fact Frenzy, your guide to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper Loss of Resources and Gambling During the COVID-19 Pandemic, a three-wave longitudinal study, intro theme music. Welcome to the Science Uncovered podcast, where we unpack the latest groundbreaking research with depth and intrigue. I'm Tom. And I'm Jen. In today's episode, we're diving into a fascinating longitudinal study that explores how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted gambling behaviors and resource loss over time. The study is titled Loss of Resources and Gambling During the COVID-19 Pandemic, a three-wave longitudinal study, and was conducted by researchers Bernadetta Lalonek-Kuleta and Rafał P. Barczuk from the John Paul II Catholic University of Lublin in Poland. This three-wave study followed a group of over 600 individuals who were active gamblers prior to the pandemic. The researchers wanted to understand how the upheaval of COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns affected both land-based and online gambling, as well as the relationship between gambling and perceived resource loss. The findings paint a really dynamic picture of how gambling evolved over the course of the pandemic. Initially, we see a sharp decline in land-based gambling as venues were forced to close. But then an interesting pattern emerges, with gamblers transitioning to online play and eventually returning to in-person options as restrictions eased. Absolutely, the researchers uncovered some really fascinating trends. And what's even more intriguing is how these gambling shifts related to the participants' feelings of resource loss, things like the loss of financial stability, social connections, and overall well-being. Let's dive into the details. The study began in November 2020, just months into the pandemic. At that point, the researchers surveyed 659 individuals who had been regular land-based gamblers prior to March 2020. They asked these participants about their gambling behaviors during three key time periods: the 6 months before the pandemic, the initial lockdown phase, and the months after restrictions were lifted. That retrospective data provides a really valuable window into how gambling habits changed over time. In the pre-pandemic period, the researchers found that land-based gambling was by far the dominant form, with many participants engaging in it on a weekly or even daily basis. However, once the lockdowns hit, that all changed. The researchers saw a significant drop in land-based gambling frequency, with a lot of the previously regular gamblers shifting to the never category. This makes sense given that physical casinos and arcades were forced to shut down during that initial phase of the pandemic. Interestingly, Though, the data shows that this land-based gambling decline wasn't necessarily matched by an equal uptick in online play right away. In fact, the researchers found that online gambling frequency only really surged in the second wave of the study, around May 2021. That's a really important point. It suggests that gamblers didn't immediately pivot to virtual options. There was almost an initial period of shock or freezing where many just stopped gambling altogether during those initial lockdowns. But then as time went on, they started to transition their habits to the online space. Exactly. And what's even more intriguing is that by the third wave of the study, in late 2021, we start to see land-based gambling creeping back up again, even as some restrictions remained in place. It's almost as if gamblers were adapting to the new normal and finding ways to return to their preferred in-person options. The researchers interpret this as evidence of a normalization process. The initial disruption and upheaval of the pandemic gave way to people finding new routines and coping mechanisms. But the fascinating part is how this gambling behavior was tied to the participants' experiences of resource loss. That's right. The study also measured how much the gamblers felt they were losing in terms of important personal, social, financial, and occupational resources due to the pandemic. And here's where things get really interesting from a psychological perspective. The data shows that resource loss was highest in that initial November 2020 survey, when the pandemic was still very new and disruptive. But over the subsequent waves, the participants reported steadily decreasing levels of resource loss. Exactly. So it seems that as people adapted to the pandemic conditions, their sense of losing valuable resources diminished. But here's the kicker. The researchers found that it was actually the gamblers' level of involvement, not just the pandemic itself, that predicted their resource loss. That's a really important insight. The more someone was engaged in gambling, whether land-based or online, the more likely they were to report significant resource loss over time. Even if the gambling levels stayed relatively stable, those who were heavier gamblers at the start of the pandemic faced a higher risk of experiencing things like financial strain, relationship troubles, and diminished well-being. It's a classic case of the resource loss spiral that the conservation of resources theory describes. Those with fewer resources to begin with, in this case, the more heavily involved gamblers, end up in a vicious cycle where each loss leads to further depletion. Meanwhile, those with more resources at the outset seem better equipped to adapt and weather the pandemic's disruptions. Absolutely. And the researchers also found that problem gambling severity remained relatively stable throughout the study period. So it wasn't necessarily that the pandemic caused a sudden spike in problem gambling, but rather that those who were already struggling with gambling issues prior to COVID continue to face those challenges, with their resource loss exacerbating the problem. That's a really important nuance. The pandemic didn't necessarily create a whole new crop of problem gamblers, but it did amplify the struggles of those who were already vulnerable. And the longitudinal nature of this study allowed the researchers to trace those dynamics over time in a way that cross-sectional research often can't capture. Exactly. By following the same group of participants through the ups and downs of the pandemic, the researchers were able to uncover these really rich, layered insights about how gambling behaviors, resource loss, and problem gambling severity all interacted. It's a great example of how powerful longitudinal research can be for understanding complex human experiences. Absolutely. This study provides such a valuable window into the psychological impact of major crises like the COVID-19 pandemic. It shows how even seemingly individual behaviors like gambling are deeply interconnected with our broader experiences of resource gain and loss. And the findings have important implications for how we support people struggling with gambling issues, especially during times of heightened stress and uncertainty. Definitely. This is really cutting-edge research that gets at the heart of the human experience. By blending statistical analysis with nuanced storytelling, the researchers have shed new light on the delicate dance between our external circumstances and our inner lives. It's a fascinating study that leaves us with plenty to ponder. Absolutely, there's so much richness to unpack here. I'm sure our listeners are just as intrigued as we are. Thanks for joining us on this journey of discovery. We'll be back soon with more insights from the frontiers of science. Until next time, keep exploring. Outro theme music. Upbeat jingle music. Are you tired of feeling like a fish out of water during the pandemic? Introducing Underwater Cities, the premier virtual gambling destination for those craving a liquid escape. That's right, folks. While the pandemic had many of us feeling like we were drowning in uncertainty, the researchers at Underwater Cities saw an opportunity. Using cutting-edge virtual reality technology, we've created the most immersive, fish-friendly gambling experience imaginable. Whether you're a landlubber or a seasoned sea captain, Underwater Cities has something for everyone. Dive into our state-of-the-art casinos, where you can spin the slots, play the tables, and even race your favorite schools of fish. All from the comfort of your own home aquarium. And the best part, at Underwater Cities, you'll never have to worry about losing valuable resources. We've stocked our virtual world with an endless supply of coral, seaweed, and glittering treasure. So what are you waiting for? Grab your snorkel and join the party at Underwater Cities, where the only thing you'll be drowning in is excitement. Underwater Cities, your gateway to a subaquatic gambling oasis. Visit us at underwatercities.com. Upbeat jingle music fades out. Intro. Hey there, welcome to the Explore Research Podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host Jen. Hi everyone. Today we'll be diving into a fascinating research paper that explores the potential of nomadic pedagogy to address the issue of school dropout rates, especially among minority groups. The paper is titled Eta Nomadic Pedagogiki Kai Eta Ekpiders Tun Myonotikon Omadon, which translates to Nomadic Pedagogy and the Education of Minority Groups. It was written by Vasilios Skarnalakis, a civil engineer and doctoral candidate in education. This study investigates whether nomadic pedagogy, an approach that moves learning beyond the constraints of the traditional classroom, can offer solutions to the problem of school dropout that plagues Greece and much of Europe. Let's dive in and explore the fascinating insights from this research body. The main goal of this study, as Vasilios explains, is to explore through literature review and thematic analysis, as well as conceptual analysis using mind maps, whether and how nomadic pedagogy can provide optimal solutions to the problems that plague today's schools, which often stem from high dropout rates. The idea behind nomadic pedagogy is that education doesn't have to be confined within the walls of a school building. It's a pedagogy that can exist and thrive outside of the traditional classroom, utilizing modern technologies to enhance the quality of learning. Vasilios was inspired to conduct this research after his own experience teaching in vocational high schools in Greece. He noticed that the curriculum and teaching methods often felt outdated and disconnected from the realities of his students' lives. Many of Vasilios's students, particularly those from minority or disadvantaged backgrounds, were struggling to engage with the material and would end up dropping out of school. He wondered if a more flexible, mobile approach to education could help keep these students invested and learning. The paper delves into the complex issue of school dropout, which the author notes is one of the most significant problems facing Greece and Europe as a whole. There's no single, universally accepted definition of this problem. Different organizations use terms like early school leaving, school dropout, and NEET, not in education, employment, or training, to describe it. However, the European Commission defines early school leavers as young people aged 18 to 24 who have completed at most lower secondary education and are not in further education or training. This lack of a unified definition makes it challenging to compare data across countries, as education systems and compulsory schooling requirements vary. What's clear is that low educational attainment is closely linked to a range of negative outcomes, including unemployment, low wages, social exclusion, and even increased likelihood of criminal behavior. This isn't just problematic for the individual, but can have far-reaching consequences for society as a whole. Vasilios points out that in Greece, school dropout rates have been especially high in recent years, particularly with the economic crisis. Certain groups, such as those in rural agricultural areas or coastal tourism regions, are more prone to leaving school early to pursue work opportunities. This is where nomadic pedagogy comes in as a potential solution. Rooted in the practices of nomadic communities around the world, this approach views education as a mobile, flexible process that can happen beyond the confines of a traditional classroom. The key principles of nomadic pedagogy are to promote basic quality education and facilitate smooth social integration. The teacher in this model isn't confined to a school building, but rather travels to where the students are, whether that's remote or isolated populations, or even students who are temporarily away from the classroom for work or other reasons. This mobility allows nomadic pedagogy to adapt to the unique needs and circumstances of diverse learners. Rather than expecting students to conform to a one-size-fits-all school system, the education comes to them, blending with their daily lives and activities. Vasilios cites research from countries like Canada, the Scandinavian nations, Russia, and Nigeria, where nomadic pedagogy has been implemented with some success. The approach aims to multiply the quality of learning by utilizing modern technologies and breaking free from the physical constraints of a school building. One of the key benefits of nomadic pedagogy, as described in the paper, is that it can help shape students' identities and transform technical knowledge into more holistic, contextual understanding. It also promotes the development of cultural and linguistic competencies, as well as social justice. The researcher does acknowledge some potential limitations of nomadic pedagogy, such as reduced classroom capacity due to the need for portable equipment. However, he argues that this challenge can be addressed through the emerging field of transportable architecture, large, flexible structures that can be easily moved and reconfigured. Overall, Vasilios makes a compelling case that nomadic pedagogy may hold the key to reducing school dropout rates, especially among marginalized groups. By bringing education to the students, rather than expecting them to conform to a rigid school system, this approach could help keep more young people engaged and on the path to academic and personal success. Reflections. Jen, what were your key takeaways from this research? What did you find most interesting or surprising? I was really struck by the holistic, student-centered approach of nomadic pedagogy. Rather than trying to force students to adapt to the school, this model adapts the education to the students' needs and circumstances. I can see how that flexibility could be incredibly valuable, especially for populations that are traditionally underserved by the mainstream education system. Absolutely. The idea of education as a mobile, responsive process rather than a fixed institution is quite radical, but it makes a lot of sense. I was also intrigued by the emphasis on developing students' identities, cultural competencies, and critical thinking skills, not just imparting technical knowledge. Me too. It seems like nomadic pedagogy really aims to empower students as whole, well-rounded individuals, not just fill their heads with facts. And the potential to leverage modern technology to enhance the learning experience is exciting. That said, I can understand the author's acknowledgement of potential practical limitations, like reduced classroom capacity. Implementing this approach at scale would likely require some innovative solutions, as you mentioned with the transportable architecture. Definitely, and we'd have to be mindful of cultural differences. What works in one context may not translate perfectly to another. But the core principles of flexibility, mobility, and student-centeredness seem universally applicable. Agreed. Overall, I found this study to be a thought-provoking exploration of an alternative educational model that could have important implications, especially for addressing the complex issue of school dropout. It really challenges us to rethink the boundaries and assumptions of traditional schooling. Conclusion. In conclusion, this research on nomadic pedagogy highlights an intriguing approach that may hold promise for increasing school engagement and reducing dropout rates, particularly among minority and disadvantaged groups. By prioritizing the needs and circumstances of individual learners, and delivering education in a more mobile, flexible way, nomadic pedagogy could help transform the school experience from a rigid institution into a responsive, empowering process. While there may be practical hurdles to overcome, the core ideas behind this pedagogical model, fostering identity development, cultural competence, critical thinking, and social justice, seem highly valuable and worth further exploration. This study really encourages us to think outside the box when it comes to education, and consider how we can make learning more responsive, engaging, and impactful for all students, regardless of their background or situation. It's an intriguing glimpse into the future of pedagogy. Absolutely, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on developments in this space. Thanks for joining us on this journey through the fascinating world of nomadic pedagogy. Until next time, keep exploring. Commercial. Are you tired of the same old, boring classrooms? Do you feel like your education is stuck in the past? Introducing Nomad Education. We're revolutionizing the way you learn. Forget stuffy textbooks and desks that don't fit your butt. Our mobile, high-tech classrooms come to you, anywhere you are. Whether you're a shepherding nomad in the mountains, a fisherman on the open sea, or a forager in the dense jungle, Nomad Education has got you covered. Our expert teachers travel with you, using the latest AR, VR, and holographic technologies to create immersive, tailored learning experiences. Learn calculus while herding reindeer. Master literature while navigating the open ocean. Become a STEM prodigy while gathering wild herbs. The world is your classroom with Nomad Education. Because learning shouldn't be confined to four walls. So ditch the desk, embrace the adventure, and get the education you deserve. Enroll in Nomad Education today. Tom and Jen, Nomad Education, learning that roams.